You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Acro, The Wave Farm. This is radio for open ears and music for open ears, too. My name is Sal Cataldi, and I am the host of Reading is Funkdemental. This is a monthly show where we talk about books about music with the authors, and often some of those authors are musicians themselves. I am a musician myself, and I play in several bands up here, including Spaghetti Eastern Music and a band called Space Heater and Guitars of Go-Go. And I also write about music for the New York Times and Rolling Stone and Pop Matters. You just heard a tune from a forthcoming album of that I worked on. It's for the soundtrack of a film called Drone Girl, and that is a tune called High Step, and followed by St. Thomas by Sonny Rollins. We're going to speak today to Aidan Levy, who just created a fantastic 700-plus page book about the jazz great Sonny Rollins. And I'm not even going to talk too much about it because this is a really very broad interview, and Aidan has way more great material than I can provide to you. So why don't you listen up, and Reading is Funkdemental is on now. Okay, well, welcome, Aidan Levy. Is it Levy or Levi?
It's Levy.
Levy. Wrong on all counts. Well, thank you for joining us. I have to say your book on Sonny Rollins, Saxophone Colossus, was one of the greatest books I read in the last couple of years, or probably ever, about music. I understand it was 7 years, 200 interviews. The book is 750 pages plus 400 pages of footnotes. Took me 3 months to read, and I went through pretty much every Sonny Rollins thing that was on Spotify and in my collection. So welcome, and congratulations on a colossus of a book.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad you enjoyed the book. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great. Well, let's get right into it. I wanted to start, you know, for folks who don't know Sonny, let's talk a little bit about his youth. He grew up in Sugar Hill in the sort of midst of the Harlem Renaissance with people like Louis Jordan as neighbors. So give us a little bit of background on, you know, sort of where he came from and how he got into the saxophone.
Yeah. He was born on September 7th, 1930. He was born in Harlem. He grew up in kind of central Harlem. And then later on, his family moved to Sugar Hill, which was kind of an affluent section of Harlem. He grew up on Edgecombe Avenue, overlooking beautiful park, and Duke Ellington lived down the block along with Paul Robeson, Joe Lewis lived right in the neighborhood. So he would really see his heroes wandering around the town. And, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois also lived on Edgecombe Avenue. He used to come home from work and he would see Sonny and his friends playing stickball and kind of shoot them a glare, not realizing that they might be the torchbearers for the next generation. But yeah, he really came to idolize Coleman Hawkins at an early age, when Hawkins' recording of Body and Soul became an unlikely hit because he really only gestures towards the melody and improvises everything based on the chord changes, based on the harmony. So that was playing in jukeboxes all over Harlem. And Sonny heard it and became captivated by that. So Hawkins happened to live in the neighborhood too. He went over to his apartment waiting for the Hawk to return home. And eventually he did. Sonny brought a glossy headshot and Hawkins signed it to him. Neither realized that 20 years later, they would meet in RCA Studios to record the album Sonny Meets Hawk.
Great album.
Yeah, but you mentioned Louis Jordan, and he was actually an earlier hero to Sonny. And Sonny discovered him because he had a residency across the street from Sonny's elementary school. And he first encountered him as another glossy headshot. There was this photographer named James J. Kriegsman, and he took photos of a lot of the stars of the music. And Sonny saw his photo with that glistening saxophone and the tuxedo with tails. And he He thought to himself, that's, I think, what I want to do when I get older. And before long, Sonny started collecting all of his records. Louis Jordan was a hero, and then Coleman Hawkins.
Well, we could go also into his youth. His family has a Caribbean background, and that would filter into his music as well as sort of his love of classic Hollywood movies.
So he grew up in a West Indian family, and St. Thomas, the song that he made famous, is a Caribbean folk song. And his mother used to sing it to him as a lullaby, but his mother Valborg also took him to calypso dances in Harlem, where he gained an appreciation for that island tradition. She
Well,
also,
one of the interesting things, just on the Caribbean note, is what I learned from your book is that Louis Farrakhan and I believe it was Maya Angelou kind of got their start as Caribbean crooners, if you will.
yeah, Louis Farrakhan got his start as the charmer, and he was a calypsonian. He actually recorded an early version of what came to be known as St. Thomas. So you can hear that as a fire down there, and it's just dripping with sexual innuendo. Maya Angelou got her start as a calypsonian during the calypso craze, and she released an album. She was kind of known as Miss Calypso. The calypso craze was going on during 1956, 57, largely in response to the success of Harry Belafonte. And Harry Belafonte ushered that in, and then there was a long while there where cultural critics were thinking that calypso might overtake rock as the dominant popular art form. Of course, that didn't come to pass, but many jazz labels responded to that craze and issued calypso albums that kind of fused calypso and jazz. Of course, many of the musicians themselves came from a West Indian background, Sonny included. I think it's a credit to the strength of Sonny's rendition of St. Thomas that he's widely credited for integrating calypso into the jazz tradition, or what you might call he also was working with Quelbe, and that was kind of a typical form for where his family was from in St. Thomas and St. Croix. But yeah, that when you listen to St. Thomas, you can hear Max Roach starting with a calypso beat, and eventually you'll hear that a cymbal hit, and he'll go into a swing rhythm. So that kind of represents the merging of these art forms.
So, and then you also obviously reference his love of Hollywood films, which, really came to the fore, I guess, with the Way Out West album and many of the covers that he did. So what are some of your sort of favorite Sonny takes on Hollywood?
Well, he loved Jerome Kern, the composer Jerome Kern. Movies like Swing Time. So he saw these in Harlem, maybe at one of the theaters that would play movies in addition to having variety acts. And then later on, he started recording the songs. Many people thought it was kind of a novelty, but these were songs that he truly loved. He really loved Westerns, and one of his favorite stars from growing up was Herb Jeffries, who became known as the Bronze Buckaroo for one of the films he starred in. Jeffries became known as the leading Black Western star, and he was also a crooner himself. Had a really beautiful voice, and you can listen to his recordings. Sonny also heard Herb Jeffries and became a fan of his music as well. Sonny loved Bing Crosby. So when you listen to a song like Wagon Wheels on Way Out West, that's another example of a song that he truly loved. Many people thought that Sonny was mocking the song, or that it was a way to show how quintessential, how hip he could be, that he could turn even the corniest tune into something that would really be on the cutting edge. But he did do that in a way, but he didn't find these tunes corny. He really loved them.
Well, he let's talk a little bit now about his high school band, which had some notables in it, and they were sort of bad boys a little bit. And then Sonny's own, you know, early sort of problems with the criminal justice system, and you said how it sort of shaped his civil rights. So let's just start from his early band, the Counts of Bebop.
Yeah. He was the leader of his band, the Counts of Bop, and that formed in Sugar Hill with many of his associates that he met either in school or just in the neighborhood. The nucleus kind of was Sonny, Arthur Taylor, Gil Coggins, another pianist who's a little bit older. You know, Jackie McLean got involved with the group at some point. It was really just kind of a murderer's row of musicians who became later associated with hard bop. And they all came from that neighborhood. So they started playing dances in the neighborhood, what were called cocktail sips at the time. One of their first gigs was at a church around the corner from where Sonny grew up, called St. Charles Church. And, you know, they would get a little bit of money. They might play Illinois Jacquette's Flying Home. So Sonny would have known that solo. You know, kind of Louis Jordan type stuff. Mm-hmm. So later on, when people were somewhat critical of Sonny for going in a more rock-oriented or pop-oriented direction, he didn't really differentiate in that way. Mm-hmm. It really just, it harkened back to his youth when he was playing these dances. He always wanted to get people moving. He recognized that the propulsive rhythm to the music was a danceable rhythm. And when people commented on bebop as high art, which it really was, Sonny found it to be a false binary to say that, well, it's high art, so therefore you can't dance to it. Right. He remembered when people used to dance to bebop, they would do a dance like the Applejack. Hmm. And when you see Thelonious Monk dancing, he was kind of doing one of those dances in a sense.
So how does he get from this band, you know, into early sessions with Miles Davis and then and sort of beyond there?
Well, through his involvement on the local scene in Harlem, he was recruited to play interludes or kind of interstitials on the set breaks when Miles Davis was leading his band. So Miles heard him playing and asked him to join the group. They became fast friends. They were really close, just hang out all the time. And then one by one, Sonny and his friends started to get recruited to play in different bands. So, you know, he started playing with a bebop singer named Fats. He was playing with Fats Navarro. Mm-hmm. He started playing with Bud Powell. You know, he... they all just kind of started to get recruited right. as these young prodigies. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened.
So then he, you know, in your book, it's very interesting. I read that, you know, when he had his stint in jail in 1954, he played in the Protestant Chapel Band, and it's there that he actually penned three of his classics. Was it Doxy, Oleo, and Aragon? Or is that how you?
Yeah. That, he did compose.
How did he come to? How did he come to be there? I guess.
Well, many musicians at the time got involved with drugs.
Yeah.
And Sonny was one of them. For a while, he didn't want to speak about it. He thought it was a source of shame, but later on realized that because he emerged unscathed from the drug scourge, that it was his duty to speak out against drugs and to show future generations that drugs were not the way to artistic success. Many of Sonny's peers felt that Charlie Parker's genius was related to his drug use.
Right.
Although Bird urged his young proteges to avoid all drugs and just felt that he himself was kind of a lost cause when it came to kicking the habit.
Yeah.
So yeah, Sonny, he did get involved with drugs and got arrested at one point, ended up doing time in Rikers, two stints. As you mentioned, he wrote those tunes while there, and in the book, I go into
probably the best thing that ever happened on Rikers, right?
A guy named Armin Georgiorian, who was important to Sonny and some of the other musicians that he encountered at Rikers.
Well, that's then what precipitated his
there.
Yeah, that's what precipitated his move to Chicago and his association with Max Roach and Clifford. It was all about trying to clean up, correct? That's why he went to Chicago.
Yeah, well, he voluntarily checked in to an early rehab center in Lexington, Kentucky. And that he took what was then known as the cure. It took about 4 months, 4.5 months. And he was one of the few success stories of that center. After he got out of Lexington, he didn't want to return to New York, where he felt there would be too many temptations.
Right.
So he went to Chicago, where there were also temptations, but he didn't know as many people there. He knew some. But what he did is he checked into the YMCA and bought a lot of cans of tomato juice and just had his horn with him. And
hello. And he worked as a janitor too, correct?
Yeah, he worked as a janitor
at Lucille
at a typewriter factory. They didn't know who he was. They called him Wally. And he just kept working on his music, stayed clean. And when he felt strong enough to go back to the clubs, he went over to a club called the Beehive, where the Clifford Brown Max Roach Quintet had a longstanding residency. And he sat in with the band, and as it turned out, he ended up joining it. So yeah, the kind of the rest is history from there. But at the time, he also had an offer to join what later became known as the first great quintet, the Miles Davis Quintet. And Miles Davis was so certain that Sonny would accept that offer that it was reported in Downbeat that Sonny had joined.
Wow.
That on the marquee for some of the early dates that band did, Sonny's name was listed, and people showed up to the gig expecting Sonny Rollins.
So let's talk about 1956. That begins his sort of most critically acclaimed run. What'd you say? 10 albums, six as a leader, I guess, between then and what, 58? So what's so special about that era to listeners and to Sonny himself, maybe?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think to some extent he was making up for lost time. And he always had a tremendous work ethic, probably the greatest work ethic in the history of jazz of anybody. So, yeah, I mean, he was just making album after album after album. And the way that Prestige worked in those days, a recording session might only take a few hours. There was very little playback. They didn't do too many takes. It was kind of first take, best take. And so he just was recording all the time in there. So yeah, Saxophone Colossus, Tenor Madness, and he those are kind of two of the best known albums from that period. But Rollins Plays for Bird, was another great one. I mean, you can just listen to any
Yeah,
album from that period and
yeah,
just
way
kind
out
of have your
west.
mind newly blown.
Yeah.
Way Out West that he recorded for Contemporary Records in Los Angeles, in his first trip to California. But the style that he became known for was the term for it was coined by the musicologist, French horn player, third stream progenitor Günther Schuller, and he called it thematic improvisation.
Right.
It emerged from an article in a short-lived publication called the Jazz Review, and Schiller called the article "Sonny Rollins and the Challenge of Thematic Improvisation."
Right.
And the article took as its musical example "Blues 7" from Saxophone Colossus, in which Sonny improvised the melody, and his solo is based around one motive or motif that he develops and consistently returns to throughout the entire improvisation. So Schiller asserts that Sonny's style exemplifies a new form of improvisation or a new development in jazz improvisation that is more thematic. Equivalent to like sonata form.
Right. So is that something that pretty much screwed with his head a bit to have his work analyzed?
That's definitely screwed with his head because he wasn't analyzing his own
Right.
work in the way that someone like Schiller was.
Yeah,
So, and
and a lot of
musicologists later on have kind of decided that Schiller's theory is perhaps a bit Eurocentric. And not as in touch with kind of Afrological thinking or groove-based musics.
Right.
But I think that to some extent, this idea of thematic improvisation is something that Sonny's working with, where he does think more melodically, he does improvise more lyrically, kind of in the Lester Young school. So Sonny has always kind of integrated the horizontal playing of Lester Young with the more vertical or harmonic playing of Coleman Hawkins. He's doing both, but when I talked to Jimmy Heath, he said he really thinks of Sonny Rollins as the key innovator in rhythmic improvisation,
Well,
that
it
he plays the
yeah.
saxophone kind of as though he's a drummer.
Yeah. Well, it's I guess it did screw was something screwed with his head enough that he obviously took the famous hiatus of what was it, for 15 months, I guess, on the bridge. So if you could talk a little bit about that first hiatus for him and what he devoted himself to when he was away from music.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it was that article that caused him to take the bridge sabbatical. I think that there were many factors, and I go into that in the book. But primarily, I think it's really that he'd risen to a level of acclaim after toiling in the salt mines for a decade. And he was suddenly finding himself winning all the polls and declared the leading tenor saxophonist of his generation. And Sonny himself didn't buy the hype.
Right.
He felt that he wasn't measuring up to the yardstick set by his heroes, Charlie Parker, Coleman Hawkins, and many others. So he took this opportunity to step back from music.
Yeah.
His wife, Lucille, had a steady job. Their rent was low. They were living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And one day, Sonny was out walking around. He had his horn in tow, as always. And he saw the span of the Williamsburg Bridge. He's yeah. walked out there onto the pedestrian walkway, and suddenly a light bulb went off, and he thought, this is the perfect place to practice.
15 hours a day.
Yeah, so he could do it 15 hours a day. One of the challenges for a wind musician, a saxophonist, and I can attest to this, is it annoys the neighbors. I had this experience in college, just playing in a dorm room, you know, and of course, you know, I'm no Sonny Rollins, but I talked to one of Sonny's childhood neighbors, and she recalled him playing all day in the apartment. And, you know, Sonny was sensitive to this issue. And if you're Sonny Rollins, you want to practice 15, 16 hours a day. When he saw the span of Williamsburg Bridge, he thought, this is the perfect place to practice. There's no neighbors to bother. And he also could harmonize with passing tugboats and subway cars going by. And that's where he really developed many of the ideas he was working with and got more comfortable with his own voice. And when he emerged from the bridge a couple of years later, in 1961, in the fall of 1961, he felt confident that he could say exactly what he wanted to say.
Right.
Now, of course, he continued searching and looking for what he referred to as that lost chord. But when he came down from the bridge, he came down as a fully self-actualized artist.
And then that was a totally different direction with the band with Jim Hall.
Yeah. So the album that he made after he returned from the bridge sabbatical was called The Bridge. That title came from the producer, George Avakian. And George signed Sonny to a contract at RCA Records. Jim Hall was in that band, and I think that the sonorities he brings to the music, particularly Sonny's rendition of God Bless the Child, that's one that I always come back to. And then there's a live version of that that the group performed on a program called Jazz Casual with Ralph Gleason. Gleason.
Yeah, it's great.
It's really just beautiful.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Sonny and free jazz at the moment. So let's talk about, you know, how that impacted him and changed his style maybe a little bit and then made him settle into something different.
Yeah, so when Sonny took the bridge sabbatical, some people thought that Ornette Coleman might have something to do with it. And I think that Sonny was aware of what Ornette was doing and became one of his early champions. But that wasn't why Sonny went onto the bridge. And Sonny first met Ornette Coleman when he went to California. And he met Don Cherry and Ornette. That was when he went and recorded Way Out West. And, you know, so Sonny recognized what Ornette Coleman was doing immediately when he heard it.
Mm-hmm.
So when Sonny came down from the bridge, he wanted to respond to that Ornette Coleman sound and what he heard on The Shape of Jazz to Come, what he heard in Ornette Coleman's legendary five spot run where he exploded onto the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he recruited Billy Higgins and Don Cherry into his band. So half of that Ornette Coleman quartet.
Mm-hmm.
They went on tour together. They made some of my favorite music, period.
Mm.
I know that when they recorded at the Village Gate, the version of Olio that they played was so long that George Avakian had to cut part of it so it could fit on one side of an LP.
Right, yeah.
But I think that it's that he takes what he heard coming out of what came to be known as free jazz, and he integrates it into the bebop tradition, into that language as well, which of course it was all part of that the same continuum, but Sonny recognized that, and I think you can really hear it when you listen to music from that era, to Sonny's music from that era.
Then he would go on to have another sabbatical, a second sabbatical, where, you know, he continued. He was a real fitness fiend. You actually, another interesting little tidbit is that he was a part of the JFK Fitness Committee. And, you know, this is when he went to India in 68. So tell us a little about that and where that led him musically.
Yeah, well, he was never officially part of the committee. I think that there were some talks for him to get involved prior to the JFK assassination. But it never came to fruition. But anyway, Sonny did become very interested in physical fitness. And this was part of what he was doing when he was on the bridge, but he continued everything he was doing on the bridge when he came off the bridge. So he was working on his mental health, his spiritual health, his physical health, and developing his technique as an artist. Mm-hmm. So when he was on the bridge, he started doing pull-ups. He had workout equipment in his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
When Charles Mingus came to visit him on the Lower East Side, he was shocked to discover that Sonny had become a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
But as I said, he was also focused on developing his spiritual connection and became intent on going to India.
Right.
And this is something that he discussed with John Coltrane, who was also interested in Eastern philosophy. So eventually in 1968, Sonny finally made the trip to Mumbai and found an ashram where he studied kind of incognito for a while until a couple jazz fans kind of caught wind that there was a jazz musician in town. They went to every ashram in the area until they found Sonny Rollins. So then his cover was kind of blown again. But yeah, he also, when he was in India, got to hear Bismillah Khan play. And, you know, he became interested in circular breathing, which is something that is kind of practice in the various Indian musical traditions. But yeah, this focus on spirituality and the bigger picture issues, that's something that's central to Sonny Rollins and still is.
Well, something else that's central to Sonny is, I guess, after the albums of the mid-50s is sort of his displeasure with his own studio recordings. Tell us a little bit about that, and then again how he ended up bringing in Lucille to sort of produce. And Lucille is a big hero of Sonny's stories, to help him with production and management and just keeping it all together. But let's talk a little bit about that, and maybe a little bit about, which I had not realized until your book, about his how the dental problem sort of plagued his career a bit and his ability to tour and perform.
So Sonny came to despise the recording studio, and a big part of that is that he was a perfectionist. He still is. So once he could listen to playback and he had the latitude to record as many takes as he wanted to, nothing was ever good enough. He was always still searching for that lost chord, still felt that he hadn't quite achieved what he wanted to on each take. And ironically, this is one of the reasons why some of the best work he did was in a live performance setting as opposed to in the studio. There just wasn't the opportunity to go back and get it right until the next gig. But Lucille, his wife, came on as his manager and producer in the early 70s. And she produced his records kind of for the rest of his career. But you asked about dental issues. He was always plagued by dental issues, and musicians always have wind instrument. Wind musicians always have to deal with dental problems to the extent that they arise, because your embouchure is so crucial to your sound. So much so that for a while there was a column in Downbeat magazine called something like "Ask the Dentist." It was written by a
Oh my
dentist.
God, that's fantastic. Gotta check into that.
And there were various dentists who became known as specializing in working in treating jazz musicians.
Well, it was,
So,
Well, it sort of was a prib, like I think it's comparable to like knee surgery today. Like I've had a friend who, had problems with his knees in the 60s, and he was operated on by Joe Namath's doctor, and it's just horrible what they did to the knee then. This was prior to arthroscopic, and I'm assuming, when so much of this work was done on Sonny's mouth, the technique, the technology was not where it is now. So
Well, he worked with an early exponent of dental implants named Stanley Nelson, who was also a renowned African American dentist at a time when it was very dominated by white men. And Stanley Nelson was a huge jazz fan, as is his son, Stanley Nelson Jr., the renowned documentary filmmaker, who's he made a great documentary on Miles Davis not too long ago, and is also a great friend to the music. There's another dentist that Sonny worked with named Philip Terman, who passed away a few years ago. And I interviewed him for the book, actually at the Friars Club. It's where we did the interview.
Wow, it's gone now, I believe.
Or something, well, I hope they bring it back. But anyway, Sonny wrote a song, in honor of Dr. Terman, Dr. Phil. And there were several people who did that. Phil Woods, I think, also has a song for him. Anyway, so Yeah,
He's the
dental issues.
Dr. Robert of jazz. The
That's
Dr.
right.
Robert.
That's ex
Yeah.
that that that's right. So yeah, like teeth are kind of can be the Achilles heel for a lot of musicians.
Well, speaking of live, and speaking of documentaries, let's talk a bit about the famous concert, which is 2 miles from me here, which is something I wrote a story about, which you were so kind enough to quote in your book. It's from the documentary called Saxophone Colossus and Sonny's famous performance at Opus 40 in Saugerties.
So this performance has become immortalized through the great Robert Muggy's film Saxophone Colossus. And I don't think Muggy realized at the time that the performance would be considered so significant. Because he was also filming Sonny's concerto, which was performed in
Right.
Japan.
That was great too.
And that's prominently featured in the film as well. But I do think at this point that people, when they think of the kind of iconic moment in the documentary, it is the moment when Sonny's playing at Opus 40 in Saugerties, and he takes a leap off the stage about 6 feet down or so.
Right.
And he was known to take this kind of leap of faith and walk into the audience during performances. But on this particular occasion, he broke his heel.
Right.
And the band didn't realize it at first. And they became a little bit concerned when Sonny didn't stand up and start walking through the crowd as he usually would. But then he came back in, picked it up with Autumn Nocturne, after he had finished his cadenza,
Yeah.
and he ended up playing the rest of the concert on his back with a broken
Right.
heel in excruciating pain.
Yeah.
So this is kind of symbolic of Sonny's work ethic, of his resilience, of his persistence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Well,
mean, it's just an amazing moment.
interestingly, I saw him live about, I believe it was about 2 weeks after that on the City Line boat tour. I think you write about it in the book, and I actually looked up the performance is available like on YouTube, and he was in a Lazy Boy lounger with his foot, with his heel or whatever in a cast, and he started with it was sort of like G-Man. I believe he played a version of Isn't She Lovely that went on for like 45 minutes and was like the most amazing thing probably I've ever seen. So that was an amazing thing. Also, around that time or a little bit before, you talk about him working with the Rolling Stones, recording. I think it was Slave and Waiting on a Friend. So how did that come about? And did that do anything for his career or his pocketbook or?
Well, it definitely he got paid for it, but he was extremely ambivalent about making that record and recording on the Stones' Tattoo You. It kind of came about as a bit of a lark, and his wife really wanted him to do it. But Sonny wasn't really interested at first. He felt that the Stones music was derivative of blues, that there was some kind of cultural appropriation going on. He wasn't sure
Right.
about doing it. Also, he had his own band that he was leading, and he didn't want to play second fiddle to anyone. The last thing he wanted was to feel like he'd been trotted out as some kind of novelty act. But
Right.
in truth, Charlie Watts was a huge Sonny Rollins fan, huge jazz fan, also a great jazz drummer in his own right.
Right.
And he wanted to get Sonny to play the saxophone solos on the album. And they didn't think he would do it at first. And Sonny was resistant, but at the urging of Lucille, he agreed to to do it. And as the story goes, Mick Jagger kind of, he asked Mick Jagger to dance what he wanted him to do. And Sonny didn't hear the album until he was in the grocery store one day and kind of pricked up his ears. He heard a saxophone solo. Oh, that's kind of interesting. Oh, wait a second, that's me. But they asked him to come on tour
right
on the back of that album, and at the time it was a record-breaking tour. They wanted to pay him an ungodly amount of money to do it, but he refused. He also refused to be credited on the album. He so that's why there's no credit to Sonny or really to anybody on that album. Yeah, it's I think it's a great kind of meeting of the minds, that album, even yeah, though Sonny.
Yeah, and that solo on Slave, it's kind of like at the end of it, he does something that almost sounds like he's playing Inside Out. The first time I had heard it, actually, I was in Mexico in a, like at a beach and staying in a hut on a straw canvas thing. And some guy was just had ingested something that probably was illegal. And he just listened to this song again and again on repeat the whole night. And it's pretty great. So that was a great moment. Another great moment, we'll take it to the end here, is I don't know if you saw the 80th, but this is the 80th birthday concert he did with, where he played with Ornette Coleman.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah, that was, well, let's take it to, you know, where, you know, Sonny's, you know, the latter part of his career, like you said, he was more comfortable with his live recording. So there were a number of live albums that came out. And unfortunately, for those who don't know, Sonny, you know, in some ways, his career was sort of victimized by what happened on 9/11, possibly to some degree. So if you can kind of go into that and take us to where he is these days.
Yeah, the 80th birthday concert was really a reunion for many of the artists that Sonny had worked with in the past, including Jim Hall. Roy Hargrove was a young artist that Sonny had mentored. And most notably, it represented his first onstage meeting with Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
And unfortunately also their last. But it was unclear if Ornette would even show up for the concert or how it would go. But Ornette does show up, and they do play for about 21 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's really just, I think, an unbelievable performance. And fortunately, it was recorded. So that you can hear released. It if you listen that, yeah. to, it was released on the Roadshows.
Yeah, right.
And series.
Which volume? Yeah.
You can hear them do Sunny Moon for Two. And you know, like I said, it's 20 minutes plus recording Sonny Rollins with Ornette Coleman, and it also represents a reconciliation for the two of them. They had not seen each other for a long time, and they resolved some tension that they had between them, and they were really very close friends. Very, very close friends. So, yeah. But a couple of years, a few years later, Sonny retired as a result of a pulmonary fibrosis diagnosis. And it's very likely that this was precipitated by his exposure to debris from 9/11,
right.
because he was living about six blocks from the towers.
Yeah, to
And
pet
he
it
was there
down.
that day and got stuck in his apartment, had to be escorted by the National Guard out of the building. But he was outside and breathed in some of that stuff. And studies have shown that there is a strong correlation between exposure to the debris from 9/11 and the development of pulmonary fibrosis. So he at first was depressed about not being able to play. It was like breathing for him. But over time, he arrived at an acceptance and he began diving deeper and deeper into his spiritual pursuits. So that's what he's concerned with today. And he's dedicated himself to promoting the idea of living by the golden rule. And you know, that's where he is today. So, you know, it's really a blessing that we still have him here on the planet. And he lives in Woodstock. So
I haven't seen him at the grocery store. I mean, I see Tony Levin at the grocery store. I see Juma Sultan at the grocery store. I've not run into Sonny, but he's in his 90s, and that's okay. But so I have to say again, this is one fantastic book. I think you've written the book on Sonny, and there won't be any more, or there shouldn't be any more. Just some things for people who don't know Sonny. What three albums might you say this is a great starting off point, and why, for people to listen to?
Great starting off point. You can start with Saxophone Colossus. You might want to listen to The Bridge. And then also, I would say Miles Davis, Bag's Groove.
Cool. And then let you've also written, I want to talk about what, briefly, you've written two other really well-known books, one on Lou Reed and one on Patti Smith. And is there anything that we can look forward to in the way you work 10 years or so?
Nothing to date, but eventually, yeah, I hope I can write another book. But yeah, nothing in the works quite yet.
Again, this was, for folks who don't know, this was 7 years of work. Again, 750 pages, 400 pages of footnotes, 200 interviews. And again, the way I read it, I do a lot of book reviews, and I read pretty fast, but I took my time with this one because I was constantly jumping back and forth to Spotify and my own record collection as I went through it, which was a great way to sort of do this. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I would recommend everybody go out there and get Aidan's book, Saxophone Colossus. Thanks again, Aidan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.